Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And we're going to travel. Maybe even a little dream travel. Well, I hope you're awake for the show. And you can dream afterwards. And this is a very advanced type of dreaming. Not many of us can dream the way our guest can. He's been on the show before. It's wonderful talking with him. He has a new book out. It's The Boy Who Died and Came Back. And that's all about him. It's Adventures of a Dream Archaeologist in the Multiverse. And after reading the book, I totally believe it. I'm fascinated. This is an incredible journey, and we should all learn from it and look forward to our own dreams. So, Robert Moss, welcome back to Energy Stew.
Good to be with you, Peter.
I'm so glad you could join us because this book is so fascinating. You've written so many books, and I haven't read them all, and I know that I have had you on the show for a previous book you did, and you're not only a fascinating guy, but you write in a way that absorbs your readers. And I took this book on vacation with me, and it absorbed me the whole time. It was rich and fascinating. So I want to talk about who you are and what you do as a dream archaeologist. This is not the kind of dreaming that most of us do. I've been trying to dream like you since I've been reading your books. And I did have a great experience in a workshop you led, and I did you had a shamanistic workshop, and I did some journeys in that workshop that were wonderful and rewarding. So I know how it can work. I just know in the middle of the night, I don't get visited the way you do. And not only the middle of the night, even during the day. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, the key thing here, Peter, is that dreaming is not fundamentally about what happens during sleep. I mean, we all talk about dreams as sleep experiences, and I value highly sleep dreams that we don't ask for and may not want because they hold up a magic mirror to our lives and they take us to places beyond the ordinary and so on. However, this whole approach, based on a life lived as an active dreamer, is one of recognizing that we can go consciously into the dream space at any time, waking, sleeping, or hyper-awake, that the world around us will speak to us in the manner of dreams through synchronicity and symbolic pop-ups if we pay attention, and that there's a lot of fun and gain to be had in between liminal spaces, like, you know, the middle of the night, you're not awake, you're not asleep, you're somewhere in between. So this is the way I've lived all my life, and you know what? It's not that difficult for other people to learn it. I mean, okay, yeah. This is a discipline. It requires practice, practice, practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? It's the same principle. You get better at dreaming by practice. But I really think that however exotic some of the experiences in my new book might seem, most people have ways of accessing a lot of the good stuff.
And you're a great leader of that and help people learn how to access that. I personally am an intuitive person. And I hear, so I actually hear a lot of information, but I don't travel. It comes to me, and so it's a different form of working in the ethers than you have. And I'm always excited about the opportunity of climbing out into these worlds and that place in between awake and sleep. I've had many times where I'm lying there and I'm hearing voices, having conversations, and even calling my name out. And yet I just see it as a curiosity because I don't know where to go with it. It's not in my normal intuitive work.
In these in-between experiences, Peter, in the hypnagogic state, that's a $5 word for it. I actually like the phrase that Tinkerbell uses in the movie version of Peter Pan, the place between sleep and awake, you know, you're in between that liminal borderline state of consciousness, very creative state. The trick really is to stay with it. You say, where to go with it? Well, you can go with it. I mean, images that rise and fall in that in-between state can become your royal road to lucid dreaming. You know, you start out lucid or conscious and you stay in that way. That's the easiest way to become a lucid dreamer. But it might be more a question of staying with it in the sense that if you're hearing voices, you know, and you're not going crazy, if you're hearing voices that are worth listening to, you might in this in-between state be able to initiate a full conversation. I mean, in The Boy Who Died and Came Back, I give many examples of receiving guidance, important guidance from inner teachers and other transpersonal sources in this in-between state. I mean, like you, I hear a lot of things too. I'm highly visual and I relish the movies and the epics that unfold, but I also receive a great deal of verbal information, often coming as a quiet voice in the mind that you learn to trust. And also you learn to test and verify these things, so you're not just picking up anything. As an intuitive, you understand that there are states of consciousness in which we are more receptive. This in-between state, this hypnagogic state, is also a state in which people can become more psychic or intuitive very easily by picking up what is in the field. So I greatly recommend that people spend more time in this twilight zone of consciousness, and it is amazing, actually, that so little worth reading has been written about it. I mean, in the spiritual adventure story of mine, The Boy Who Died and Came Back, I give many examples of how it's worked in my life. In some of my other books, I give, you know, more hands-on guidance on people on how to play in the zone.
Right, and that's the point, is to also read your other books, because you also do workshops, and when you're drumming, you know, that facilitates that altered state.
I mean, this is my approach, which I call active dreaming, is the marriage of shamanism and dream work. It uses very simple shamanic techniques for shifting consciousness. We don't do chemicals. We make our own. We use drumming. We use simple drumming. And I have found that 80% of cognitive left brain oriented Westerners can get off on a lucid dream journey right away. First exposure to shamanic drumming in 12 to 15 minutes, provided that it's been set up well. They've been given a good agenda. They've been given a good itinerary. They've been given a portal image, a gateway image, and the intentions are set clearly and well. One of my favorite methods for helping people become conscious dream travelers is to get them to pull up an image from their life. It might be an image from a dream. It might be an image from some other part of life, an image that has some juice and some energy, and invites them really to go into a space. So, for example, you've dreamed of being in an interesting building, having a conversation. You've been in that building in your dream. You could go there again. Similarly, for a life memory, you remember being on the beach as a kid, and you remember the smells of the water and so on. You can go into that place and use that memory as a portal or gateway image to get out there and start a lucid dream adventure. And for this, the drumming in the workshops works like a charm.
All right. Now, this is basic stuff that your other books are about, and yet The Boy Who Died and Came Back is about your archaeological work. And that's what was so fascinating is that you're a shaman who is trying to know the riches of this world more fully rather than, and this is what you say in your book, rather than the Eastern mystics who seek to travel beyond this world, liberated from the illusion of this world. You're climbing into the illusions and learning to know them better in detail, with data that you actually bring back from these dream journeys. And you can talk to anthropologists and archaeologists with data that they're looking for.
Well, my practice is that of the Western way and also that of the indigenous way. In both traditions, Western and indigenous, we value images. We value this world. We value the world of nature. We value the spirits of nature. And a cardinal principle here was enunciated by the great Frenchman René Dumas, who said, "The gates to the invisible must be visible. Gates to the invisible must be visible." So what I do for people and do in my own practice is to take gateways of images, images we can use to go to interesting places that may take us beyond time and into other dimensions and into parallel worlds and worlds where the dead are at home and alive and places of teaching, healing, and initiation in what I would call the imaginal realm. That, again, is a term very much from the Western tradition. And we understand the Western tradition also has deep roots in Islamic and Judaic culture and so on, where that concept is well understood. So, yes, I mean, I treasure the play of images. I don't want to give up the play of images. To say that it's all illusion misses out on a lot of the magic of everyday life for me and misses out on a lot of the gateways that can take us from this world to worlds behind the world.
Right, and the act of dreaming that you do takes you to back in time to places and people who also were dreamers. And,
yes.
And so in that way, you can access the strengths of their dreaming and
yes.
The powers that they used, for instance, using power animals or using other aspects of nature and talk with them and learn from them. And they've taught you.
Yes, I think we have the ability to establish direct lines of contact with intelligences in other times and other dimensions in ways that are rational, work, are life-supporting, and actually can assist people in different times simultaneously. When I talk about dream archaeology, my basic thought underlying this invented phrase is that archaeology, when you go to the root of the word, means the study of the primal or first things. That's what it means, the ashe, the primary most important things. A dream archaeologist is somebody who uses the tools of shamanic dreaming, as I briefly defined them, to go on conscious adventures to establish connection with wisdom keepers of different traditions and bring back authentic knowledge of what our ancestors knew, and also facilitate ancestral healing and bring alive traditions that are worth cherishing today. I mean, that's part of it. The last part of this book recounts some of my adventures on the trails of this world, particularly in Eastern Europe, but also in other places, working with whole communities of people, you know, groups of 40 or more active dreamers going on shared shamanic journeys to contact the ancestors, to contact the wise ones, to see what from the past we need to harvest and what we need to sift out and reject because it no longer serves us. So this is a grand adventure, and it's an exercise of living consciously in this world while carrying the knowledge of other worlds, Peter. And you know from the book that it was a real challenge for me to learn to do that, because as a kid I found it very hard to stay in this world. As an adult, I try to help people keep it together in the body in an integrated way while understanding that there is a deeper reality and looking for clues in everyday life and in everyday dreams to the nature of that deeper reality.
Right. And you also have scouts who scout out the future for you.
To scout out the future? Yes. I mean, one of the survival functions of dreaming, and once again, we can do this wide awake and conscious, or we can do it in our sleep, one of the survival functions of dreaming is that that some aspect of the self, some part of the psyche, is forever traveling ahead of where we are in the body to check out challenges and opportunities that lie in the future. I have, you know, in a number of my books, I have now recounted hundreds of examples of this, both of dream precognition, which means, as you know, that we see something ahead of time and then the event happens and we say, oh, well, I saw that. If that kind of thing involves a huge event, you might call it prophecy. If it involves more specific events, you might simply call it premonition or precognition. But more interesting than seeing the future in the sense of observing something ahead of time that will happen is receiving early warnings or early advisories on possible future events, the kind of information that can help you to make better choices and avoid futures that you don't like and manifest futures that you do like. I mean, in The Boy Who Died and Came Back, I gave some examples of how I've been able to do that, and I write about that in other books too. And frankly, I could not be on the phone talking to you today, Peter, if I had not avoided dates with death on the road in car accidents, to my certain knowledge, three times, by using dream information that scouted out possibly fatal situations and enabled me to handle myself on a road that avoided those fatal encounters.
It's fascinating. And you've also visited the House of Time. Can you explain that?
Well, actually, we were just in the House of Time all weekend. I was up on a mountain in the New York Adirondacks leading a group of my frequent flyers at a place that we've met for many, many years where I test fly the techniques. And we went into this location. It is a location in non-ordinary reality. It exists. The House of Time is a constructed locale, as the Empire State Building is a constructed locale that exists in a world that is real, which I call the imaginal realm, and people can go there and they can do things. It is a rich environment with many levels, many rooms, many spaces, and people can travel through these spaces to access past lives, future lives, parallel lives, to travel across time to meet master teachers. You know, although this might sound exotic, Peter, this is part of the grand tradition of training for initiates in the mystery tradition, the Western mystery traditions. This is a very specific, fresh, and original version of it, but involves a kind of locale that creators, mystics, shamans, and so on have longed to go for and spend time in across the millennia. And
how does this compare?
In The Boy Who Died and Came Back, I give the story of some quite remarkable expeditions we made through the House of Time, which actually actually took us to the Sirius star system to see seriously whether their intelligence is associated with that
and that's fascinating.
In non-ordinary reality that we can usefully connect with.
Right, that's in your book, and that's fascinating.
Yes. I must say, Peter, sometimes when I read this book, now I have some distance from it, because, I mean, it's out there. In fact, I talk about it as the boy, as if it's a separate individual, you know, my child wandering the world, and I'm trying to track his progress. But as I look at it with some distance, I must say I'm personally amazed by some of the stories in this book. I'm not saying that I doubt them. These stories are the facts of my life as I understand them, but I am somewhat amazed that these stories can be found in a book in this way.
Now, the House of Time, how does that compare to the Akashic Records?
Well, there's probably interface, and maybe more than interface. It may be that when you get to the library of the House of Time, you're in the Akashic Records, because when you get to the library, which has restricted areas, by the way, you have to earn the price of entry to the good stuff. That's always the case. But when you get deep into the House of Time and its library, you may be in the Akashic Records. But around that, there are all these interesting spaces where you connect with an object, an artwork, an artifact from another time, and immediately transported to the realm from which it comes. And you have this opportunity, Peter, not only to explore your personal relationship with someone in a past or a future life, but to communicate mentally with them across time. This is where this approach parts company with, let's say, the past life regression approach or something like that. I think we are connected to the dramas of personalities in other times. I think that's part of our story. And we want to understand, when appropriate, some key elements of our relationship with those other personalities in past, future, or parallel times. But we also want to rise to the understanding that, from a certain point of view, it's all going on right now, and that we might be able to interact, at least on a mental level, with those personalities who are part of our spiritual family, our counterparts in other times, and do some mutual good for each other. That is where this approach becomes really terribly, terribly interesting.
Yes,
and experiments are possible for people, which can change your life for the better. And are worth trying.
It's so fascinating. And now, within the House of Time is a Library of Time, and you found some writers there who you became friendly with. For instance, good old Jack.
Good old Jack, yes. Jack Lewis.
That's C.S. Lewis. For those who don't know that C.S. Lewis is
Let me tell you a funny thing about that. I was leading one of my journeys for a group some years ago, and I said, let's go to a library. It might turn out to be the library of the House of Time, but it'll just start out like looking like a library you know. Picture a library you know. We're going to have a journey. We'll drum. You're going to find a master teacher, and you're going to discuss a story that you need to know about. So I picked the New York Public Library. I'm going up the steps. There are the lions. And inside, I find there's a display. It's interesting. There's a clue for me. This is a journey. This is a non-physical journey with the drum. I'm drumming for the group. And there are C.S. Lewis, whose friends called him Jack, and Tolkien. And I have a pleasant encounter with them. I mean, my inner skeptic is saying this can't possibly be C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. But I'm having a good time. The conversation is great. Tolkien says very seriously, earnestly to me, Robert, you must study Scandinavian mythology. You don't know nearly enough about Scandinavian mythology. So I sort of note this down. Some years later, I'm writing one of my books. It was published as The Dreamer's Book of the Dead. And, you know, I'm doing a lot of my stuff in the middle of the night, both writing and lingering in that in-between state. And I have the sense of a presence, and it looks like Jack Lewis with his pot of beer and his tweedy jacket and so on. And I'm, the humorist to me says, well, where's Tolkien? And Jack Lewis says, oh, Tolkien wouldn't come because you didn't do your assignment to study Scandinavian mythology deeply, so Tolkien's not available to you right now. And I'm laughing at all this. And I'm thinking, well, you know, I mean, this is crazy, of course, except that creators judge by the creative value of the material. So in all my conversations with my version of W.B. Yeats, for example, which goes much further than my limited association with Lewis, I have gained specific clues and inspiration and guidance on many, many things that has really been quite wonderfully illuminating and inspiring in my life. So I'm less interested in whether this is the individual spirit of the dead poet, the great poet W.B. Yeats, or the part of me that is like him, or some personality essence that is out there. What I notice is the creative flow-through, and the creative flow through has been tremendous. And this library, this House of Time we're talking about, is a place where I lead people to have encounters with master teachers in their field of interest. And the encounters are sometimes really quite remarkable.
Right. Now, it's great to work in that direction. You also find old shamans who are still around. and from ancient theaters of life in Lithuania, and then you talk so much about goddesses and bees, and I mean I used your book while I was on vacation because I was in the sun, and I was a little concerned about having too much sun, and so I decided to draw on a power animal to help me with the sun, and I asked for a power animal to be shown to me, and a yellow lizard showed up, and I realized that I had to use its skin, so it offered it to cover me with its skin, and I felt very protected after that.
Wow. I love it. Absolutely love it, Peter. And so you survived the sun okay, I trust.
Yes, I came back. I was fine.
Puts a whole new spin on that kind of phrase we use to each other when somebody's spending a lot of time sunning themselves at the beach or by the pool. You know, you're living like a lizard. it works. I mean, putting on the lizard skin works. There's a story in The Boy Who Died and Came Back about something similar, about how when I found myself in the high Andes in Peru, I was slightly concerned about, you know, the altitude and my body adjusting to the altitude, and I allowed another power animal, not one familiar to me, though I love the big cats, but I allowed the puma of the high Andes to come into my body and adjust, you know, my blood pressure and the other systems of my body so I could cope at the high altitudes. And I found for the 10 days that followed, after allowing the puma to become my ally in my body, it seemed, that I was as fit and well, maybe more so than anybody else on those mountains, had no fear of heights, and things work differently. You know, somebody listening might say, well, that's auto-suggestion. I would say, well, if it's auto-suggestion, it works like that, that's pretty good, and that's quite enough for me. But those of us who work in the shaman's way with the power animals are of the conviction that it's something more than auto-suggestion, that there are forces beyond the ordinary that we are able to invoke and use, and you just gave us a great example of it.
Right, and then the other aspect of this is that we have to give back to them. We have to feed them with something.
And that's right. If you're going to sustain a relationship with a power animal, you have to feed and honor that animal in your life. I don't know what you... Are you eating things that lizards would like to eat, Peter?
No, actually, I asked it what it needed, and it asked for darkness. So I knew that at night I had to make sure it was dark enough.
Okay, well, that's one way of feeding and honoring the connection.
Yes.
I'm very insistent about this. I mean, people feel that they've got a connection with an animal spirit and they go and look it up in a book. I mean, that's not enough. I mean, there's some books that are good on this, although the best books on this are going to be books by people who live close to nature and observe the animal in nature, and better than that is going to be to make your own observation when you can, and better still is going to be what you did, which is to ask the animal itself what it needs, and then you want to probably use your body in some ways that would suit the animal, and also want to consider what in your diet would feed the animal and what would disgust it. I mean, all of this is part of TLC, of conserving and maintaining a good relationship with the power animals, which I recommend for all the reasons you understand and then some. It's a good way of finding the natural path of our own energies. It's a good way of raising, you know, vital energy, and it gives us very specific guidance and protection in very specific situations, as in your story of the sun.
Yes, and you have a story about bees.
About bees?
Yes.
Yes, well, bees, I'm not an expert on bees, and lots of being written about bees these days, but in my life, bees have played a very positive role in taking me to things that I needed to see. I mean, in the book, I write about a night when I'm lying in that in-between state, and I notice there's a buzzing around me. Initially, I think it's a physical buzzing of one or two insects in the room. Then I realize there's a whole swarm of bees are gathered around me, and these are non-ordinary bees, but it's completely real. And they lift me out of my physical body and take me in a second body, a subtle body, an astral body, if you like, off to what seems to be a scene of initiation, the epopteia, the high point of the mysteries in ancient Greece. I mean, this really had a huge effect on me. And since then, I found myself, whenever I go to culture, living cultures that honor the bees deeply, like, for example, in the Baltic, Austea, the bee goddess of Lithuania, is still very much alive in the land, and her tradition never died out. Lithuania is a country, amongst all its other stories and dramas, where the old goddess tradition, the old old goddess civilization that Maria Gimbutas wrote about has remained intact across all the millennia. When the Indo-European storm gods came down, they coexisted with the old goddess tradition, but never supplanted it. When the church came in, it might have tried to supplant it, but it never succeeded. I mean, in that country, the goddess tradition is alive, and the bee goddess, Austea, is one of the most benign and interesting forms of the deity. And when I go to that country, I'm very conscious of all that the bees represent.
Well, I noticed that you talk about Lithuania near the end of the book, and I thought that you did that for a reason, because it is so dramatic and rich, the information in the past that you journey into, and the experiences that the ancients in Lithuania had, that I felt that it was so dramatic and rich and deep that you needed to be well into the book to be able to handle it.
Well, maybe so. I mean, I saved for the last part of the book, I saved some of my adventures in this world. I feel it's funny. We find soul countries in our lives. Lithuania is one of my soul countries. I'm not sure altogether why, but it's a country that has drawn me again and again. I've taught there half a dozen times now over the last decade. It's the country of Maria Gimbutas, the great scholar of the goddess. I find that the goddess tradition, to which I'm drawn, though a mere man, I mean, I'm a soldier of the goddess, I can't help it. I find the goddess tradition is there in the land speaking to me when I go to that country. I find that in other places too. But some of the adventures and some of the adventures in Lithuania are remarkable, and I put some of them at the end of the book. I mean, they're really like a very powerful dessert, if you like. And of course, the very last part of the book, the epilogue, tells the tale, the extraordinary tale, of how, in ordinary reality, in a cafe by a little river next to the old city of Vilnius, the old town part of Vilnius, I was appointed dream ambassador for the Republic of the Other Side, which is an artist community next to the old town of Vilnius. And so, you know, I have grand adventures there. And on my last visit, we pursued the trail of a medieval shaman priest, and my goodness, we found him, and he communicated. So, you know, there are places where the veils go thin, and of course, the gates to the other world can open from absolutely wherever you are, and then there are sites and countries where things just, you know, come upon you in an extraordinary way, more easily than in other places.
And reading your book and books is so important, to be conscious of who we are in that capacity, and opening up opportunity just because we know it exists. We only have a couple minutes left, so I want to get back to this book in particular, The Boy Who Died and Came Back, and your name is Robert Moss. What website can people go to?
My website is mossdreams.com. That's M-O-S-S, like the stuff that grows on trees, dreams, plural, mossdreams.com. And you can find me on Facebook, as they say. I have several Facebook pages.
I know. I see your Facebook postings all the time. And I love that. And it's incredible talking with you. And I want to talk more about this book in a future show, because there's so much that we didn't even touch on, including all that happened to you when you moved up close to the Adirondacks. And
yeah, that's quite an interesting story. If you want to know about how past life experiences can impact the modern life, this is a pretty, you know, striking narrative.
And we'll get into that hopefully soon in the future. It's so incredible to talk with you, Robert. I loved talking with you before, and taking your workshop was extremely helpful. And I think you're doing an incredible service to the world by opening us up to our dream facilities.
It's an absolute pleasure talking with you, Peter. You go deep. You have a questing mind. You're not shy about sharing your own experiences. And this makes for great conversations.
Well, thank you, Robert. It's great conversing with you. And all the best in your journeys.
And may your best dreams come true, Peter.
Thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org, or 212-222-7748. I'd love to hear from you. I have lots of classes I'm teaching at heartriver.org. You can find out all about it. And thank you so much for listening.